Hello, my name is Dave Emery. Welcome to For the Record Program 237, an interview with Kevin Coogan. The gentleman with whom we've been speaking and have spoken in the past is, of course, Kevin Coogan, last name C-O-O-G-A-N, the author of the consummately important text, Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, published in softcover by Autano Media, and copyright 1999. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about a very important section of your book, Kevin, which you entitled Shadow Reich. And one of the key people that figures in the Shadow Reich and in this portion of your book is a fellow named Werner Naumann. We've touched on him before. If you would fill us in briefly as to who he was.
Yes, Werner Naumann is truly a mysterious individual. He began in the early 1930s as a member of the SA, in fact, as a high-ranking member of the SA, and survived the purge that Hitler did to the SA through the Night of the Long Knives.
By the way, those were the brown shirts, the stormtroopers one hears about. Go ahead.
Yeah, Ernst Röhm, those guys.
Right.
He then became a very close aide to Joseph Goebbels, in fact, so much so that at the end of the war, after Goebbels committed suicide, Naumann was promoted by Hitler to become the Minister of Propaganda.
Succeeding in that capacity, Goebbels.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Exactly. Then he was quite literally in the party with Martin Bormann when Martin Bormann disappeared from the bunker after Hitler's suicide. And just like Bormann, Naumann basically disappeared. Unlike Bormann, who may or may not be dead, I don't really have an opinion strongly one way or the other. I'm kind of an agnostic on this. Naumann surfaced, much to everyone's surprise, in the late 1940s when he showed up running a corporation called H&S Lucht Incorporated, based in Dusseldorf. And the mystery of H&S Lucht, L-U-C-H-T, was that it was itself raided by the British High Commissioner for Germany, a guy named Yvonne Kirkpatrick, because it was Kirkpatrick accused the company of being the linchpin for a post-war neo-Nazi revival. So all of a sudden, Naumann, who just really kind of disappeared for about 4 years, surfaces in this mysterious business, an export-import firm, which the British actually cracked down. Because remember, at that time, Germany did not have autonomy. It was divided up into different zones, where the Americans, the French, the British, and the Russians. So Naumann became a very important player in this post-war Reich. And what I try to show in my book is that the Naumann network was intimately connected with Yockey's network, because the Naumann network worked very closely with both Fred Weiss and H. Keith Thompson, who were Yockey supporters in New York. So that's how he really enters my book.
A couple of points, parenthetically. Werner Naumann, you write, also served in the Waffen-SS.
Yes.
And Francis Parker Yockey, of course, is a key fascist theoretician and operative before, during, and after World War II. Not a name most people know about, but someone who has exerted a profound influence through his Imperium opus on contemporary fascism. And that's the context for that name for people who have not heard you before. Kevin, speaking about the Lucht company and some of the people associated with it, the name Otto Skorzeny jumps out, and you write in your book that most people think about the Third Reich, and they think about fascism, and they think about links to the right wing or to the West. You point out that this post-war fascist milieu or Shadow Reich had profound connections to the East Bloc. Develop that for us, if you would.
Well, it did have connections with the East Bloc, and during the investigation of the company, some of those connections began to come out. For example, Skorzeny was believed to have been involved in actually helping to recruit some engineers and technicians through an operation in East Germany itself. And Skorzeny was an adjunct of the H&S Lucht company in Spain, where Skorzeny was living in exile. Now, I have to say this gets very confusing very quickly, because Skorzeny was also used by the CIA,
right,
to supply weapons to the for example, to Egypt during the early 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So what appears to have happened is that the H&S Lucht company, which itself seems to have been a kind of a front company for some of the more heavily connected people in the post-war Nazi International, in particular a man named Leon de Grel, who had been a former SS general who was also living in exile in Spain, they seem to basically be playing kind of both sides of the coin. And one reason for this, I believe, is that German industry was itself particularly interested in rebuilding and getting connections to the East Bloc and to the Third World as well. So they had an interest in sort of playing both sides.
De Grel, by the way, a Belgian fascist leader and a key Waffen-SS officer. One of the things you talk about, Kevin, in addition to links to the East Bloc, and this actually dovetails with one of the comments you made near the end of your last development of information, and that concerns the links between the Naumann milieu and the Shadow Reich and various liberation or, quote, anti-imperialist movements in the Third World, particularly the Middle East. I wonder if you'd tell us more about that, both during the World War II period in terms of the Third Reich's connections to those, and also in the post-World War II or Shadow Reich phase that you write about.
Well, actually, in a certain sense, I would even start with World War I. In the war between the Germans and the British during World War I, the Middle East was a very important zone of contention. And what happened is that the Germans were looking around for sort of anti-imperialist, anti-British groups in the Middle East to support, in the same way that the Germans were helping to support the IRA in World War I. So essentially, the relationship between German intelligence and elements in the Middle East against the British began at that point. It was really carried on during World War II as well. And a lot of the people that you find the Naumann network in connection with, for example, the young officers of Egypt, who helped spawn Nasser, who later became the head of Egypt, they had links with German intelligence during World War II because they were nationalists who wanted essentially to overthrow the British and at that time were being helped by the Germans. So really, after 1945, there's still a continuation of networks that existed before 1945 and really go back, I think, in some way to around the period of World War I. So this isn't something that just appears. There's a long-standing relationship between these elements. And what happens is that the Naumann network itself had particularly good ties with the Egyptians and with the Nasser group in particular. And Naumann and his people were very supportive of the coup in Egypt against King Farouk, who was basically supported by the British. And I have in my book a long section on this, including a long reprint from a very fascinating Italian fascist publication, giving the details of that support.
You mention, actually you quote that long Italian fascist article, and it discusses Nasser's attempts at overthrowing the British during the Second World War in 1942. Of course, he was successful operating in conjunction with some of those same elements, as you write, after the war. I also would note in that regard, just by way of fleshing some of this out for listeners, that there was a coup in Iraq against the British led by a fellow named Ali Rashid, who had a profound influence on Saddam Hussein's political development through his uncle, who raised Saddam Hussein. And also, a fellow named Zahedi was the coup leader against the British in 1942. Kevin, a person who wielded a profound influence both with the Third Reich, or at least in some of its Middle Eastern and Third World connections, and also in the Middle East and Third World, was Haji Amin al-Husseini. Tell us about him, if you would.
Well, al-Husseini, who's often called the Grand Mufti, was really a religious leader of the Palestinians in Jerusalem. Like so many people, he became very anti-British and got wound up, really, with the Third Reich. So during the war, he was backing the very strongly involved, in fact, with the attempted coup in Iran. He then had to flee, and actually he fled first to Italy and then to Germany during World War II. And in Germany, he made propaganda broadcasts for the Nazis. He also helped encourage a Waffen-SS division of Muslims to fight with the Germans. He later returned to the Middle East and set up his headquarters in Egypt. In fact, when I was doing my research, I came across letters that the Grand Mufti had written to this group, the National Renaissance Party in New York, which was a group very much tied in with a man named Fred Weiss, who was one of Yaki's major patrons. And he also, the Grand Mufti, also had very strong ties with the Naumann organization, and they kept regular contact with him. Now, again, in this very curious world, the Grand Mufti was also one of the major creators of something called the World Muslim Congress, the WMC. And the World Muslim Congress turned out to be a pretty notorious organization. I mean, even in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, they were circulating, you know, Henry Ford's book, the International Jew. They were sending out copies of this book to members of the British Parliament. They were promoting the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. They're a pretty scurrilous group, actually. But they were also at the same time tied in. They were one of the wing elements of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, the APACL, which itself was actually supported by the CIA.
Kevin, interjecting very briefly, this is not a name that is known to most people, but you might want to just encapsulate the World Anti-Communist League, or WACL, with which both of these elements work, or to which it belonged, and mention its journalistic appearance in the Iran-Contra affair, just real briefly.
Well, that's the WACL comes up a little bit later because in the 1980s, General John Singlaub, was the head of WACL, and he became involved in a lot of sort of dirty trick operations with the Contras and people like that.
Right.
But during the 50s, really, the best way to understand WACL is that it was a coalition of, at that time, I should say, it was still the APACL. It was only created as WACL in the 1960s.
Right.
In fact, there was a book called Inside the League by John Lee Anderson, which is the history of WACL, which I would recommend to your readers to get mm-hmm. more details. But basically, what it was is it was the old remnants of the Galen organization, kind of Nazi intelligence networks, groups like the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations,
right.
the Ukrainian Nationalists, etc., extreme anti-communist groups, including groups in Asia, which basically were kind of on the payroll of the Americans, but had very strong ties with the Germans because many of them had been supported by the Germans during World War II.
Anwar Sadat and the World Muslim Congress. You write about that briefly, but with Sadat's fame in the post-World War II period, some of his earlier incarnations, politically speaking, might be of interest.
Well, Sadat's a good example of how complicated the story is, because Sadat was a strong supporter of Nasser and the Young Officers' Rebellion. He also had strong sympathies with the Nazis. Again, I would have to stress, as an Arab nationalist, he later in the 50s, and I should say parenthetically, one reason why I was interested in this is that Yaqi spends an important amount of time in Egypt in the early 1950s. In fact, Yaqi is in Cairo in the period of kind of late 1952. He's going back and forth between Cairo and Germany. And for me, this is also very relevant because one of Yaqi's other major supporters, a man named Johann von Leers, who I think we've mentioned in
an
earlier broadcast,
right.
Who had also been, like Naumann, had worked very closely with Goebbels, he later becomes kind of the head of anti-Zionist propaganda and actually moves to Egypt and lives in Egypt. And I even got letters from von Leers from Cairo writing to one of Yaqi's supporters in New York, a man named H. Keith Thompson, outlining his own von Leers outlining what he's doing in Cairo itself with this anti-Jewish propaganda. So Sadat is one of these people who during this time, Sadat works for the Grand Mufti in the World Muslim Congress, and actually is one of the directors of the World Muslim Congress. So Sadat, who later, of course, changes his political views. At that time, was himself one of these nationalists very strongly tied, an anti-imperialist nationalist in his own mind, very strongly tied with the Grand Mufti.
Kevin, one of the things that you write about, too, in terms of the Naumann group and the connections between that milieu to the Middle East and some of the liberation movements there, you mentioned that the Naumann group was working very closely with Mossadegh in Iran. His name has cropped up in connection with a relatively well-publicized, at least in retrospect, CIA-supported coup against Mossadegh, and yet here we have elements of what you call the Shadow Reich working with Mossadegh. Tell us more about that, if you would.
Well, again, this goes into a very murky area. The way I actually understand it, the best way I can understand it, is to say that German business wanted operations. They wanted to revive their power in the Middle East, and they were kind of caught in a funny position because, on the one hand, they wanted to set up their own independent networks. For example, there was a very important moment where the Hayam Erschacht, who was a very important figure in German big business, both during the Hitler period and then after, he was involved in trying to set up a shipping operation to get direct access to oil from Saudi Arabia, which was opposed by the CIA. And in a book called Spooks by a guy named Jim Hogan, investigative journalist, there's a long discussion of the complicated relationship and the kind of war, the kind of covert war that went on between Schacht and the CIA. at the same time, Schock, for example, was trying to open up ties with Communist China at a point when the American position was to embargo any trade with Communist China. So on the one hand, these German business and extreme right and Nazi interests are working with the Americans in the sense that they are being supported by the Americans, the Galen organization sort of being incorporated with the CIA, but at the same time, they want their own independent operation. They want to reestablish their own power. So you get a very complicated process where, they'll lean towards the Americans. They'll also lean towards the Russians to mm-hmm. play off against the Americans, because they're most looking forward to try and find elements inside these countries, like Egypt, for example, like people like Nasser, who they know already would be sympathetic to them, so that if Nasser takes power, it would be German big business that would be invited to help reorganize the economy of Egypt. So you have to sort of understand there's a very complicated dance going on here, and one can't simply sort of reduce it to sort of black and white categories. At least I couldn't.
Well, one of the things that I think you point out at considerable length and very clearly in your book is that simplistic dichotomizations into right and left, or imperial or anti-imperialist, cliches I can't stand, but they are at best imprecise, if not irrelevant, in the context of an awful lot of what was really going on.
That's right.
Kevin, you mentioned that the Naumann Group, we were talking about the Naumann Group connection to Mossadegh. I just want to mention in passing before we get to our next major point that when the CIA coup took place, and there's recently been some discussion in the media after some declassification of some documents about that coup, Mossadegh was eventually replaced because he was trying to nationalize petroleum interests. That, of course, was not pleasing to either the Americans or the British. The fellow that replaced him, obviously the Shah was put back in power, but the fellow who replaced him as prime minister after the coup was Fazlollah Zahedi, who led the 1942 coup attempt against the British. He ultimately married the Shah's sister, helped in developing the SAVAK, the Shah's secret police. Ultimately, his son Ardashir Zahedi became the Shah's ambassador to the United States in the late 1970s.
Can I just add one little point on this?
Sure.
To make the picture even more murky, there's an element inside the CIA which clearly wants the old British and French colonial powers out of the Middle East. And the CIA at times seems very much inclined to basically weaken the old colonial powers mm-hmm. because they are also blocking not just the Germans, they're also blocking American power in the region as well. So again, there's a lot of murky doings in the CIA, and this comes up very clearly in the 1956 war, where basically, and I mean by that the war when England, France, and Israel fought against Nasser, where the Americans basically took a hands-off position on that war. And so again, it's a very complicated period.
And I think it's very important, too, for people to understand that even, say, in the context of the CIA, it's not one institution, but rather there are many factions, and they often work at cross-purposes. And, of course, the CIA is only one of America's intelligence agencies.
Right.
And then there are other intelligence agencies as well. I think, particularly in the 1990s, perhaps the age of conspiracy theory, or at least pop conspiracy theory, I think an awful lot of this stuff has been badly oversimplified in terms of the literature that's been made available.
Sure.
Kevin, we were talking about Otto Skorzeny, and we've spoken at considerable length about Egypt. Actually, before we get to Egypt, one of the things that I wanted to touch on was jumping back to Haj Amin al-Husseini, mm-hmm. his role in the Bandung Conference and the coining of the concept and term Third World.
Well, this was a very interesting period because first of all, the Bandung Conference was essentially a meeting of the major kind of nationalist leaders of the Third World, who included Nehru, Sukarno, and most importantly, Zhou Enlai, in Indonesia.
Parenthetically, Kevin, for younger listeners, he was the Prime Minister of China.
Right, under Mao.
Right.
What you had developed was, through the Bandung Conference, you had really the first idea of the Third World as opposed to both the Americans and the Russians. And what happened is that the concept was, could you play off the Americans and the Russians sort of for the benefit of these other countries, of these emerging nationalist countries? And so you had people like the Grand Mufti supporting the Bandung Conference. You also have to remember that Indonesia is a heavily Muslim population, so there are religious links there as well.
Right. Now, we were talking about the Middle East, and again, that's one of the major places where Haj Amin al-Husseini held sway. In connection with the Lucht organization, we've spoken about Otto Skorzeny, and I wonder, by way of transition to discussion of the bomb for Nasser, as you termed it in one chapter, the role of the Skorzeny milieu in the coup against Nasser and in turn the coup against Farouk and in turn with the helping to the construction of the Nasser National Security Establishment.
Well, I should reference for the listeners what I mean by a bomb for Nasser is that when Yaki was in Egypt, one of his projects was to sell the Egyptians and Nasser in particular on this idea of a special bomb. And I try to trace that back actually to where I think his proposal was coming from, which was from this group, the Der Weg group, which was a group headed by Johann von Leers, which is working in Argentina. So that's sort of the origins of that, the title of the chapter, A Bomb for Nasser.
Right.
But what happened is that after the coup, the Germans just flooded into Egypt. And this is actually kind of poignant in a certain sense because the communists who became the supporters of the coup at the same time when Nasser was actually rounding up a lot of communists and putting them in concentration camps, which were being run by German security officers. So you had this very strange period where when Nasser took power in Egypt, the line inside the communist parties for the immediate takeover period was that Nasser was a fascist working with the Nazis. But when Nasser, and this actually occurred when Nasser and Sadat and people like that basically refused to ally Egypt with the Americans in a proposed sort of mini-NATO treaty for the Middle East. Instead, they began looking around for suppliers of weapons, and they actually went to Czechoslovakia, and they began buying weapons from the Soviet bloc. So because they were taking an independent position, the Russians under Khrushchev began suddenly to develop very friendly relations with Nasser. Yet at the same time, the Egyptian Communist Party was absolutely decimated and people were thrown in these horrible concentration camps. So you've got this very strange situation of, on the one hand, Nasser being a seemingly, you know, now he's suddenly an anti-imperialist, at the same time locking in jail the supporters of communism in Egypt.
Kevin, real briefly, because we've only got a couple of minutes
left,
the bomb, the quote, cobalt bomb, unquote, that you talk about developed by the Der Weg group in Argentina. Tell us about that, if you would.
Well, this is sort of complicated because the cobalt bomb was... The best way to understand it is that there had been in Argentina a lot of Nazi scientists. I mean, not all the Nazis went to the United States or to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
A good many of them actually wound up in Argentina, thanks to Perón. And one of them began working on this idea of a cobalt bomb. In fact, he was given a research institute by Nasser. And what I speculate in the book, based on the fact that, for example, Fred Weiss, who was the guy that Yaki was working with in New York, he had very close ties to the Der Weg group and actually wrote for the Der Weg publications. And you can find correspondence between Fred Weiss and the Der Weg group. My speculation is that Yaki was basically working as kind of a front man for the Der Weg group, which was trying to basically export their own version of weapons technology from Argentina to Egypt. And they saw Nasser the same way they saw Perón, who was basically a nationalist in need of military support. Because remember, the old sources of weapons for Egypt, which had been primarily, you know, England, countries like England and France, they were cut off because Nasser overthrew the British-backed ruler, King Farouk. So I see Yaki as working in kind of a mercenary position inside Egypt for this operation. At one point, Yaki actually got into trouble because the American embassy actually tracked him down and was on the lookout for him, and he basically disappeared from Egypt. So this is part of my chapter on that whole period.
Kevin, right at the end of the interview, looking ahead to a later element that we'll discuss at some length, there's been a lot of press devoted to the Elian Gonzalez episode and the ongoing hostility between the U.S. and Cuba, as was the case with other Third World countries and Soviet bloc countries. Yaki and the Nauman milieu, the Shadow Reich, bridge that gap to a certain extent. Tell us briefly, because we're almost out of time, about Yaki and Castro.
Well, very briefly, Yaki was actually in Cuba after the after Castro took power and was trying to work to develop connections with the Cubans. He'd also been in Cuba on a few occasions. If you go back and you look at the propaganda of the Yaki group in New York, for example, a group called the National Renaissance Party, which is financed by Fred Weiss, they're putting out literature regularly in support of the Ba'ath Party in Iraq. They were supporting Sukarno in Indonesia. They were supporting Castro. They were supporting Peron. They had this whole policy. They were getting money from Nasser's Ministry of Information. So there's this very weird, quote, anti-imperialist yet far-right grouping in which you've got to see Yaki within that context.
All righty. Well, we're out of time, Kevin. We've been speaking with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Postwar Fascist International, and Yaki in Cuba is a subject we'll take up at greater length in a future interview. The book was published in soft cover by Autano Media, copyright 1999. Autano Media can be found at P.O. Box 568 or written to at P.O. Box 568, Williamsburg Station, Williamsburg Station, Brooklyn, New York, 11211-0568, USA. Phone and fax, 718-963-2603. And you can visit their website at www.autonomedia.org. That's AUTONOMEDIA.org. ISBN number 1-57022027-039-2. And the book was edited, by the way, by Dave Mandel, who has an air slot on WFMU in East Orange, New Jersey, which carries these broadcasts. So, Kevin, it has been a pleasure, as always, to visit with you. We'll take up more of your very important book at some point in the future.
Thank you very much.
For Kevin Coogan, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening to For the Record program number 237.